weirdos.
Nerd science is the revolution. Nerd science is the revolution.
Welcome, all you weirdos, figments of Tony Stark's imagination, and everyone just glad that Magneto was wearing pants again. It is time to prepare yourself for your 94th Weird Dose of X, the mutant member of your weird science family. I am your stuck-inside-a-giant-Venus-flytrap host, Jason, and speaking with me while deciding which color hat to wear today is my pal, Ruben. Hey, Ruben, how the heck are you?
I'm posed like a tarot card as well.
Posed, as always. I mean, that goes without saying. I figured I don't even mention that. So you've got your three different color. I'm picturing berets, perhaps. Your different berets you're going to go with. You're not quite sure which one fits your mood today.
Okay, sure.
So when you make that decision, just break in and let us know, because that's the most important decision we have to talk about today. We will, beyond the hat situation, beyond the haberdashery, we will be talking about three books. Wolverine number 47, Resurrection of Magneto number 4, and Invincible Iron Man number 17. But first, a bit of news. Over this past week, we learned some new details on three more of the From the Ashes launch titles, these being Phoenix, X-Force, and NYX. I don't think you pronounce it Nyx. It's all capital, so I'm just going to go NYX. So the first of these is Phoenix, written by Stephanie Phillips. Phillips has written for Harley Quinn and Wonder Woman, and she also did that Rogue and Gambit miniseries that you and I reviewed, which we didn't love so much, but, you know, this could be good. It promises to be a cosmic-type book, which isn't something we've really gotten in the Krakoan era, and I'd like to see Jean in a cosmic kind of setting. What do you think about Cosmic Jean by Stephanie Phillips?
I'm not excited by Jean Grey stories. I kind of find them boring, but setting it in a cosmic space makes me think it could be something new. So I'm cautiously optimistic. I was really not excited when I was like, oh, another Jean Grey Phoenix, you know, solo book. But I'll check it out. I'll give it a chance.
She's such a powerful character. It can be hard to write powerful characters and keep the book interesting. But putting her in a cosmic setting, that kind of maybe gives her some villains and some problems of the same scale, which could work. The solicits say that Nova, Richard Rider, will be part of at least the first arc as well. So that'll be fun. I hope he's recovered from taking that hit from Pestilence at the end of X-Men Red. I don't think we've really seen him since he got kind of knocked down by that. So that'll be nice. The next book is X-Force, to be written by Jeff Thorne, writer of such books as Green Lantern and Mosaic. And I just learned this, and I put this on Slack. In the 1980s and 90s, Jeff Thorne was also an actor on the TV show In the Heat of the Night, which starred Carol O'Connor, a.k.a. Archie Bunker. So I'm just picturing, you know, the guy writing this book hanging out with Archie Bunker, and that's just a connection in my head I never expected to happen. So for me, that's fun. This book seems like it could be pretty interesting. The team leader is going to be Forge. We like Forge. And the team he puts together includes Rachel Summers and Betsy Braddock, which means this is the Rachel and Betsy book that had been teased earlier. There's also Sage, Surge, which is going to be just way too confusing, Sage and Surge, and Tank. And then when the cover and the first list were revealed, we found out that Beast is also involved. Now, Forge, Sage, and Beast, those are characters I'm interested enough to check out. And I think that Jeff Thorne is the kind of writer who, I don't always love what he produces, but he takes big swings. He's willing to deal with big ideas. And I think this is a line of books that going to need someone willing to make some crazy choices and see what happens. So I'm looking forward to seeing what this book is. Possibly more than most of the other titles, really. You have anything to add about X-Force by Jeffrey Thorne?
Yeah, I didn't know that the writer was the same one writing Green Lantern. People seem to be liking that over at DC, so I'm not reading it.
Not the current Green Lantern. He's written Green Lantern in the past.
I see.
John Stewart Green Lantern, I believe.
Got it. Well, I really have no opinion of him. But my only concern is the cover makes this team look like there's like 14 or 15 characters on the team, which, you know, we didn't even have space for Omega Red to speak in the current run. And I'm really worried about a team being that large. I'm not sure how they're going to handle it. I think even in the 90s, they split X-Men into like X-Men and Uncanny teams just because there were too many. I feel like once you get more than
the blue team and the gold team, we've had that before.
Yeah. I feel like once you get more than like five characters, you start to lose focus. So hopefully it's not as bloated as it looks.
Yeah, but I mean, that is that might just be a cover. That might just be, you know, the artist putting lots of people on there. But we will certainly find out, because we'll be talking about that book. And then there's NYX, to be written by Colin Kelly and Jackson Lansing. They've written a whole bunch of books, never for all that long, which is not a great sign. They've been on Captain America, Green Arrow, Guardians of the Galaxy. They did the one-shot Devil's Reign Winter Soldier, which I really liked. This looks to be mostly about young characters, which makes it seem not all that different from Exceptional X-Men, except this is going to be set, of course, in New York City. The cast includes Ms. Marvel, who hails from just across the river in Jersey City, so she can take the PATH train and commute. Also, Wolverine, Laura version, Anole, Prodigy, who we see over in Dead X-Men right now, and Sophie Cuckoo. I get my cuckoos confused sometimes. This is not Phoebe Cuckoo, who's currently in the Wolverine book. This is Sophie Cuckoo, who's supposed to be like the strongest of the cuckoos. Some, whether or not written as identical, she's written as the strongest one.
The one that broke away from the group at one point and was evil.
I'm not familiar with that story, but that sounds right. Yeah.
That was the Morrison run originally. There was like one that was like a dominant personality that wanted to not be part of the collective.
That Morrison run, I got to get to that soon. I know there's a whole bunch of stuff that I just need to know from that run, but I've read little bits and pieces of it, but never front to back. I am going to claim a correct prediction here, because when we first learned that there was going to be a book called NYX, I said, you know, hey, Laura first appeared in comics in NYX, the first volume. So yeah, saying that she's back again, I'm going to take a point for that. Pretty good, I think. One more small bit of news. This comes from Tom Brevoort's blog. He says that one thing he'll be pushing for as the new editor of the X line is more solo books. He thinks that team books, like kind of like you said, they can get kind of random, like any 5 to 7 characters that happen to be lying around get scooped up and put on a team. So he thinks there should be more titles about an individual character. And he thinks that more mutant characters can carry solo books than have gotten a chance in the past. So we have Phoenix. We know already that there'll be a Storm and, of course, a Wolverine book coming. Any other characters you think might get their own solo books in the From the Ashes era? Anything you'd want to see?
That I want to see. I don't know who they would pick, which is weird, but I wouldn't mind seeing a Beast solo book to see how this new Beast deals with the status quo of everybody knowing about his, you know, well, assuming the continuity just continues, right? That there's not some sort of weird continuity reset.
Which I think some of the solicits mention, oh, Krakoa's gone and they're, you know, doing new things now. So I don't think we're going to be wiping it out of continuity.
I know everybody says they think that Scott Summers is incredibly boring, but I'd always, you know, it's probably my favorite X-Man. Maybe because I'm so boring myself. I wouldn't mind seeing like a Scott Summers solo story.
That could be good. And it does seem like Scott and Jean are not going to be, you know, so close to each other, at least at the beginning of this era. You know, Jean's off in space and all. So seeing what Scott's up to could be fun. But yeah, a Beast solo would be intriguing because he's going to have this very different perspective at being this Silver Age or Bronze Age kind of character, you know, looking at the current X status quo and not having lived through everything. That could be a lot of fun.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking.
I'm going to say maybe Nightcrawler. I just like Nightcrawler. Always happy to see him doing things. He's a fun character. His power is cool and good to see on panel, but not so overly strong that you have to, you know, send him out into space or, you know, he's going to be warping reality. So I want to see some more Nightcrawler.
Yeah, depending on who the writer is, you give me another Legion solo story and I'll read that.
that has the power problem in space. Yeah, that's the thing with Legion. Yeah. So as far as the schedule goes, X-Men 700, that's the book that wraps up Krakoa, publishes on July 10th. And then we're going to get a new number one X book every week for the next 4 weeks. So on the 17th, we have X-Men by Jed MacKay. The 24th, it's Phoenix. The 31st, it's X-Force. And on the 7th, we get Uncanny. And then the first issue of Eve Ewing's Exceptional X-Men doesn't hit until the beginning of September. So starting in July, we're going to be getting these new books kind of coming on regularly. And it'll be fun to watch that ramp up. At least, I hope it's fun. I'm still a little nervous about what's coming next, but new number ones are always a good time, so we will check that out for sure. All right, on to the actual books of this week. I'm supposed to push a button. Oh, Jim took the ding sound off of here. There it is. You'd think after 94 episodes, I'd be able to find the ding sound. The first book we're going to talk about is Wolverine number 47, part 7, titled Bad Seed. written, of course, by Victor Laval and Benjamin Percy, art by Jeff Shaw, colors by Alex Sinclair, and letters by Corey Pettit. So where did we leave off? Wolverine, Sabretooth, and the Exiles have all collided in a secret forge lab deep below Krakoa. Quentin's there too, or at least part of him, and Sabretooth has just zapped Logan with Forge's famous, or possibly infamous, demutantifying gun, which means no more mutant healing power for Logan. But he can still pop his claws out. How does that work? Are his claws not a mutant power? I thought it was kind of part of the package with his healing thing. So how are we supposed to take this claw deal, do you think?
Yeah, well, he had the bone claws, right? It is sort of, I mean, that's part of his body, right? When he, before he got the adamantium, he had bone claws and the healing factor. So you would think the bone claws would go away, or at least they'd just be in your arm and you, I don't know. But maybe it's muscle, sure. Right? Maybe it's muscle at that point.
What does this gun do to physical things? Like, if you zap Angel, would the wings go away? It's a fictional gun doing a fictional zappy thing, so it mostly does whatever the writers want. I was just curious if this had come up before. If I was writing this, I might have it so that he got zapped when the claws were already out, and then maybe he can't put them away while he doesn't have powers, which would be, you know, awkward in the bathroom, perhaps. But that's how I do it. And I almost hate to ask this, but he's still got the adamantium on his bones.
I was like, I guess it's the muscle strength is how he moves it. I mean, I don't know. The way it looks like to me is you could just cut him down to the bone, but you couldn't cut through it. And that's kind of it.
Yeah. So he still has that internal kind of armor. But I'm wondering, is adamantium poisoning still a thing without his healing factor? Is he now going to die of that?
Yeah, just not immediately.
Maybe. I'm just curious. He's probably not going to be demuted all that long where it matters. But, you know, fun things to think about. On to the plot. As usual, we're going to be going out of order and combining related scenes together just for ease of discussion. Let's start by checking in on Laura, who's still imprisoned on Orcus Station number 5. My observation last issue, I get another point for this. I'm on a roll. Turns out to be correct. She does use that electronic Roomba-looking thing she took off the neck of the headless Sabretooth, open the door of her glass cage. She enters a conveniently placed crawl space, which the writers even say, oh, it's always convenient to have a crawl space, so, okay, hang a lampshade on it, that's fine. She kills a few headless saber teeth, one using her toe claw, which is always fun to see. That doesn't come up often enough, I think. And then she uses the Roomba to, I'm not quite sure, she traces a signal back to the control room. There's some mumbo jumbo about how she can hear a change. I didn't really buy it. I thought this was a clumsy little link, but however she gets there, she gets to the control room, and she runs into Lady Sabretooth in that control room, and they have the big fight that was promised on the cover of the issue. Now, I read someone online refer to this character as Shebertooth, and now I'm just mad I didn't think of that first, because it's right there. So from now on, until her, well, not much longer, but she's going to be Shebertooth to me forever. Now, this fight page is packed entirely, you know, one double page spread gets the whole fight. Which is a cool idea, but I had trouble following what the hell was going on here. Lots of claws.
I didn't like the fight very much because it's just a blur of images, and I couldn't see the choreography on the page. Mm-hmm. The art itself is good, but it's just not laid out in a way that you track it as this cool fight.
We liked when something similar happened. I think it was the very, very first issue when Sabretooth, you know, had a fight there with Wolverine early on. And that one, we didn't follow punch by punch, but it didn't seem to matter as much. This one, I want to know what's going on, because it seems to end up with, well, Shebertooth is dead at the end. R.I.P. Shebertooth. It looks like Laura slices off her whole hand and then rips off her entire torso from her body. So if you just take that one big figure of Laura and Shebertooth kind of in the foreground, I think that is a cool image, but just jumbled with everything else, it doesn't stand out as much as it really should. And now, for good measure, Laura takes Shebertooth's heart and she throws it at the transmitter that controls the mindless saber teeth, I think, and there's this big explosion. For a second, I thought she had like a Gambit kind of a power. There's no reason the explosion should be big. It reminds me of those old Star Trek episodes where the consoles on the bridge were always just blowing up dramatically. And if she blew up that control thing, then it should be, logically, I would say, that all the mindless one, headless saber teeth should like stop working, right? Wasn't that what else was she trying to get at me? There's a whole bit of dialogue about what she's doing.
Yes.
And I don't get it. What am I missing?
Well, the only thing that, if I'm going to zero, you know, score it and retcon what's going on. You have a scene where Graydon takes control, right? He exerts some sort of influence using the equipment that's part of his suit. So maybe it continues to work because he's sort of taken over it.
I could buy that. If it's not explained clearly enough, if that's the case, but yeah, then why even have her do this? It just seems confusing to me.
Yeah,
but I'll go with that. I like your explanation a lot better. Okay, so Laura's in this control room by herself now with the dead Sabretooth. She finds her radio and sends a "get me the hell out of here" message to the rest of X-Force, and then Graydon Creed walks in, flanked by Camo Sabretooth and those mindless Sabretooth, who I guess we're going to say Graydon's controlling. Graydon now wants to be called Bad Seed, which, hey, that's the title of this issue. Not a great name.
I super rolled my eyes when I saw that.
Also,
especially because
name.
There's a, I don't know if you have, well, you've got kids. Did you ever read any of those, The Good Egg and the Bad Seed and all that stuff? There's a bunch of kids' books.
I know the movie The Bad Seed. Wasn't that Macaulay Culkin? It was about some evil kid. I think it was a Macaulay Culkin book, and that's what I think of. And there's also an actual, you know, killing seed later on in this book. So I don't know if there's supposed to be a connection there. Again, just kind of confusing. There's some cool ideas in this book, but they all seem to get in each other's way a bit. So Laura tells the baddies, hey, I've got backup on the way, guys. And the baddies say, yeah, good. We want that. So expect that fight next time. On to Krakoa further north, a.k.a. the greenhouse. Here, Phoebe is taking a well-earned rest when the disembodied head of Quentin Quire turns up for a psychic self-pity session. Quentin also fills Phoebe in, not in a sexy way, about how he's under Sabretooth's technological control. Phoebe tells him to resist, but Quentin says, can't do that, it's too late. I wonder why Quentin's able to have a full conversation with Phoebe now, when 3 issues ago he could just transmit one brief flash. Is he getting better at resisting? Is Sabretooth just distracted? I'm fine either way, but it did seem kind of, something had to happen to make it okay to have this conversation now. But I'm all right with it. And now for the final and longest set of scenes, let's go back down under Krakoa into that secret lab. Wolverine, of course, zapped by that gun, has no healing factor. Sabretooth attacks and claws Logan's chest, cutting him deeply enough that really, he should pretty quickly be dead from blood loss alone. It's notable that through this whole section, the narration boxes are from Sabretooth's point of view, never from Wolverine's. We don't get Logan's thoughts anywhere in this book, which is kind of interesting. Sabretooth is torn between wanting Logan dead and wanting to fight him forever, which is a fittingly comic booky theme for, you know, enemies through the years, very Batman Joker sort of a thing. The fight goes back and forth, but Sabretooth has a wild card on his side, Quentin. He calls Quentin Headcase, which is funny because it's true. He's a head and he's in a case. I don't know if that was on purpose, but it made me laugh. Sabretooth forces Quentin to manifest a giant pink gun, wants him to kill Logan with it via instant brain death. And this is when Quentin makes that psychic phone call to Phoebe. Quentin takes the shot, Logan goes down screaming in a pretty cool art page there. He looks dead, but obviously he isn't. This is part 7 of 10, and we know that Logan survives to be in Fall of the House of X, so Logan's going to be all right. Even Sabretooth knows that Logan isn't dead. I expected that it was going to be one of those, Sabretooth thinks he's dead, but it's revealed later he's not, but no. Sabretooth knows, yeah, he's not really dead, can hear him breathing. Sabretooth gets ready to finish Logan off with a claw through the jugular, but he sees a villain, of course, so you gotta make a speech first. It's comic book law. Sabretooth says to Logan, I wanted you kicking and screaming. I wanted you raw and rough. And Ruben, I know you're not on Twitter anymore, but that's a panel that has made a certain set of Twitter fans very excited. So if that's what you're into, guys, here's your panel. You can post it on Twitter all you want. Moving on, before Creed can finish Logan off, one way or another, Necra, the vampire-looking gal from the Exiles, she enters the fight. Her whole deal is that the stronger her angry and violent emotions get, the stronger she gets physically. Right now, she's pretty strong, and she's like kind of an actual physical match for Sabretooth, which is fun to see. She is not at all a fan of Sabretooth, who screwed her and the rest of the Exiles over several times across several volumes of that book. Quentin is now able to completely resist Sabretooth's wishes. Little late, Quentin, but better late than never. He manifests a giant Wolverine claw to gouge Creed's chest out. Pretty cool looking art again. Again, how can he resist so completely freely right now? Again, super convenient, but it's a comic book. I'm okay. While Creed is down, Necra finally fires that Chekhov's gun. It's been hanging on the wall since summer of 2022. Yes, she takes that killing seed, formerly known as Death Seed, the one she got from Doug Ramsey in Sabretooth number 5, throws it on the ground next to the fallen Creed. And the result is, I guess it's like a giant Venus flytrap? I don't know what I was expecting, but I thought this was a little bit underwhelming. I've been waiting so long to see this pay off, and it wasn't as big and cool as I wanted. Was I expecting too much? Was this cool enough? I expect a lot, I know.
I was not impressed. I was just like, okay, so this is just a thing the Sabretooth will punch through at some point.
Yeah, we don't know what's going on in there. Is it like being in the pit? Is there psychological stuff, Krakoa stuff going on? The actual Krakoa's hibernating, so that probably isn't happening. I
just assumed it was like acid, sticky acid, and... Could be. Since he regenerates.
Like a Sarlacc pit sort of thing.
Yeah, perpetual pain.
That doesn't seem like a Doug kind of thing to do, but that was back when Doug was really Doug. And again, this is only issue 7 of 10 of the Sabretooth War, so we know Sabretooth will be back again. But he is at least trapped inside a plant for now, which in a way, again, a little bit like House of X number 6 all over again for him, unless maybe acid. The exiles are going to leave, and they're going to take Logan with them. They think their job is done, right? They found Sabretooth. They hit him with the seed. They're going to go home. Quentin says that he wants to be left behind. He thinks that maybe there's something in this lab he can use to restore his body. And he says he wants to stay a while and enjoy the show, meaning watch this plant digest Sabretooth. So either way, for us, this means that when Sabretooth escapes, probably next issue, Quentin will still be there to either fight him or to get captured again. Maybe both. And now we cut to the exiles running out of the lab area in a god-awful hurry for some reason, which I don't get. Is there something chasing them? Why are they just, you know, running like hell? They plead with their sentient ship to get them out of their ASAP, which the ship does. A beam comes out of the ship that hits the rocks. There's a slam sound effect. And then we cut to everybody safely aboard the ship.
It's like they think there's a self-destruct sequence that's not actually there.
It feels to me like something was cut out of the issue, that there was originally at some point a threat that they were fleeing from, and the threat was cut away, but the fleeing wasn't. Also, how they escaped after the ship makes a hole under the ocean. I mean, the water should be flooding in. There should be drowning. It's just a weird cut. I don't know what's going on. But they're on the ship. Logan wakes up in a hospital bed, bloody and bandaged. Oya is there to greet him. She knows him from her time at the Jean Grey School, so they've hung out together. Logan wants to go after the other Sabretooth out there. He does use the term Sabretooth right there on panel, which made me chuckle. When Oya points out reasonably, hey, Logan, you ain't got no powers now, Logan just says, I'm going to need a new suit and a weapon. Now, Logan has used special suits before when he's been depowered. On the Slack, Matt Razor mentioned this, shared a cover from a 2014 Wolverine, where he was in an armored suit with attached claws and holding a gun. A commenter on the House to Astonish blog points out something from all the way back in X-Force number 4, December 2019, which is the issue when Domino got her Krakoan tech gauntlet weapon. In that same scene, Logan looks at his pool of molten adamantium in Forge's lab and says to Forge, that gives me an idea. Don't suppose you could make me... dot, dot, dot. And then he's interrupted. I don't think we ever found out what Logan wanted Forge to make for him. Possible that this suit will pay off that scene 4.5 years later, which would be a lot of fun. It's still Ben Percy, you know? He'd be paying off his own, you know, plot line from way back at the beginning, which I'd enjoy that if that's what happens. That's a question for the next issue. But this issue ends here, and it was okay. You know, I like to nitpick some how does that work, how's it connected, but I liked a lot of it. The twisted father-son-mentor-student relationship between Logan and Quentin continues. I like that. The killing seed finally pays off, kind of. Necra got to be a badass. That was cool. We do lose yet another cast member, R.I.P. Sabretooth. So the only Sabretooth still alive are Camo Sabretooth and the normal 616 Victor Creed himself. And maybe you can count Graydon Creed 2 kind of in there. A.K.A. Bad Seed.
Yeah, so I can't call him Graydon anymore.
That's his dead days, yes. A few confusing bits along the way. Some pretty good violent art from Jeff Shaw, other than that one confusing page with Laura and Sabretooth. I gotta say Sabretooth as often as I can, because I'm not gonna get to do it again. So, dead Sabretooth. Logan getting zapped by the Quentin gun was probably, I think, the highlight of the art. I like that panel a lot. Put it all together, I give this issue 7.3 out of 10. There's three parts left of the story, and that's starting to feel like plenty. We should be moving on to the end game of this sooner than later. How about you, Ruben? What do you think?
Yeah, I'm starting to get to the point where I just am bored. So I'm just going to give it a 6. It was okay, but you know, I'm not the biggest fan of Wolverine to begin with, and it's just starting to feel like a generic Wolverine story at this point. And the fights are going on too long, and when the fights aren't detailed and awesome, I just kind of wonder what's the point of a Wolverine story.
It did promise to be the most violent Wolverine story ever, and you know, it's living up to what it said. So yeah, I'm trending in the same direction. I think I enjoyed some of the bits more than you did. I kind of like Necra. I did like that we got to see that seed being used, but yeah, there were a lot of bits where I wanted to like it more than I did, where I thought, oh, it's a cool idea, doesn't quite get to the levels it should. But you know, we've got three more issues to go, and I'm looking forward to them. Moving on to our second issue, which is Resurrection of Magneto, number 4 of 4, Reawakening. Written, of course, by Al Ewing. Art by Luciano Vecchio. Colors by David Curiel and Jesus Apertov. Letters by Joe Sabino. Design by Tom Muller and Jay Bowen. Unlike the prior couple issues, this issue actually has a straightforward, comprehensible plot, which my little brain enjoyed. There are still tarot and philosophical allusions aplenty, but layered on top of, you know, actual things happening. Also appreciated, Magneto did put on some clothes between issues. Very happy about that. Before the plot, let's do the symbolism first, kind of get that out of the way. The very first page here shows Magneto between two pillars, with three versions of his helmet floating above his head, and confronting two Orcus beekeepers in the lower corners of the page, which very closely mirrors a tarot card called the Hierophant. I hope I said that correctly. He's a priest sitting between two columns, facing followers in front of him in the two lower corners of the card. Also, and this is a nice touch, on the floor in front of the Hierophant are two keys, and on the floor in front of Magneto are two magnetic key cards. That's pretty funny. I like that. Jumping to the very end of the book, the very final page shows Magneto floating, holding two metal sticks that he just uses lightning rods. We'll get to that. This is a near copy of the tarot card called The World, which shows a floating figure holding two batons. Lots of other details match up. He's inside an oval reef. There's an X above him. There are four faces around Magneto. In the lower corners are Storm and Blue Marvel, who are actually in the scene. And in the upper corners, we see Emma Frost and Tony Stark, who aren't really there, but were just talked about, and again, we'll get to why. The figure on the world is surrounded by four faces, a lion, a bull, a cherub, and an eagle. The name of that card, The World, is also mirrored in a phrase that Magneto uses throughout the issue, a phrase that comes from the Talmud, which is, to save one life is to save the world. Okay, that's the tarot. One more bit of symbolism alluded to in the opening. Those three helmets, there's a white, red, and black Magneto helmet, and Magneto keeps all three of them floating along with him for the first 10 pages of the comic. The black one, we're told in the narration boxes directly, this black helmet represents the Magneto of old, who was all about rage and vengeance. The white helmet represents Charles, or maybe Charles's influence on Magneto, all about self-sacrifice. The final helmet, the red one, is about neither of those hypothetical extremes. We're told this represents, quote, to Magneto, my way. No points at all for guessing which helmet Magneto eventually chooses. Now, I was trying to put these helmets into continuity, but I decided that is not the way to understand this. For instance, the black helmet's supposed to represent the Magneto of old, and it didn't even exist until like 2014? It was as far back as I could trace it?
Yeah, I don't like that retcon.
Yeah, because until then, the old Magneto, of course, wore the red helmet. I think Ewing is prioritizing like black, white, and symbolism, you know, darkness and light. I don't know how red is in the middle there. If anything, it should be gray, but he's got to get to red because we all know Magneto's going to wear red. So cool idea for the symbolism, Al. I don't think it was quite pulled off. Again, unless I'm a dummy and I'm missing something obvious and the symbolism works on a level that I don't see. Listeners, if I am missing something, please let me know, but I don't think it quite, it's not carrying the weight that Al Ewing clearly wants it to carry. Okay, symbolism, push that out of the way. Talk about the story. Magneto enters an Orcus mutant prison facility in the middle of the ocean, and he starts beating up the Orcus beekeepers inside. Gently, though, relatively speaking. Tons of narration boxes, Magneto thinking deep thoughts about power and responsibility, you know, like he's the freaking Spider-Man or something. When Mags easily takes down the regular goons, Orcus sends in special goons, Squad Zero. Their deal is, well, they're not all that much tougher or better armed than the regular goons, but they're wearing suits that have magnetic field sensors in them. If, quote, any fancy magnetic powers touch them, nerve gas will be released into the cells, killing 1,000 imprisoned mutants. How does Magneto escape from this comic book trolley problem? What subtle plan does Al Ewing come up with? Magneto uses his magnetic powers really, really fast. Like, super fast. He squishes the five Squad Zero goons into disgusting, bloody spheres of flesh and metal too quickly for the sensors to send out the signals. Which looks pretty cool on the page, but as a solution to the philosophical problem that was presented, I thought it fell flat. I thought that was kind of a silly solution. What was supposed to be gained here? What are we learning about Magneto?
I think there's some evolution here in his character because, you know, he doesn't want to kill these guys, but he's comfortable doing it if that's what's called for. So that's slightly different, right? I think the, you know, original version would have no problem killing. The Charles version might be more like self-sacrificing, and we get something more in the middle. I was less annoyed with, you know, does this demonstrate anything about Magneto? And more concerned with the idea of Orcus having this, like, clever plan that's actually not that clever. Like, you'd think they would know how fast Magneto's powers work,
and
right?
Also, Magneto's been dead, and I'm not sure if they know that, but that they have this special anti-Magneto squad, and they get it to this particular prison that quickly. Again, convenient so that Al Ewing can do the symbolic thing he wants to do. This is also the moment right after the squishing where Magneto officially chooses that red helmet to put on, which conveniently he was already wearing a fully red outfit. So, you know, it would clash if he went any other way. Again, almost like he knew all along which one he was going to choose.
And then he talks about remembering the names of the people that he killed. So I guess he recognizes they were people.
I'll go with it.
I guess they go on the wall.
Added to the wall, yeah. Now we cut to outside on top of the prison. Prisoners are out of their cells. They exit through a portal to Blue Marvel's headquarters. Magneto then crushes the empty prison to scrap metal. Not quite done yet, though. One more fight. A Stark Sentinel shows up. And in this book, it's quite tough.
Yeah, this also bothered me.
Yeah, some books, I mean, they defeat them so easily. This one, it takes a lot to do it. Go ahead, Ruben.
Yeah, I mean, it bothered me in the sense of, like, this is the version we've been shown, right? But this one, like, takes on two Omega-level mutants and gives them a run for their money. Plus Blue Marvel. And they even talk about, like, we better not be here if, you know, a group of these shows up, right? And then...
Again, it does let Al Ewing do the kind of symbolic, thematic thing he wants to do, because the only way that they're actually able to defeat it is to form a human-slash-mutant circuit, right? We've been seeing these mutant circuits a lot, especially in Al Ewing books, but adding a human to the circuit is kind of thematically saying, okay, we tried to do our own thing. We were separatists. We had our own island, our own nation, and that didn't work out so well. So now we need to integrate back into the human world. And part of that is allowing a very powerful human to be part of one of our circuits. So cool idea. I like that idea. I like that symbolism. It wasn't leaned into overly hard, which I like. It was subtle, but it made the point. So what they do is that Magneto forms these big rock'em sock'em robot fists out of the scrap metal. It's originally not strong enough to defeat the Sentinel, but makes these kind of lightning rods. Those are the two wands we see at the end. And Storm and Blue Marvel kind of add in their power, makes an electromagnet. I'm not sure the physics work, but that's okay. The symbolism works. And now all powered up, he can beat up the Sentinel. There's a thing here where first he just kind of cracks through the facade of the face of the Sentinel, and we can see the technology below. And that's supposed to be symbolic too, but it's not like these Sentinels ever pretended to be anything other than giant fighting robots. So I don't think that symbolism worked as well. But as soon as there's a kind of a crack in their armor, then Storm and Blue Marvel can, you know, get their zappy zaps in there and blow it up.
Yes. I feel like somebody not that impressive was able just to, like, go up and, like, punch it in the leg and destroy it in one of the recent issues.
We've been seeing a variety. Maybe there's, like, quality control issues at the Sentinel factory. You know, some of them come off the line, you know, with the tolerances not quite up to spec.
Okay, I'll buy that. I like that.
That's the best I can come up with. last thing that happens before the final tarot card pose is that Storm gets a psychic message from Emma Frost. Emma knows that Magneto is back, and she requests that Magneto, quote, rescue her husband, which is why Emma and Tony appear on that final tarot card page, and why Magneto will also appear in the next book we discuss today. Now, so, what did you think of this issue? I thought it was pretty good. As always, I acknowledge this kind of heavy symbolism fundamentally not for me. I know lots of people on the internet thinks this is the best thing since sliced bacon. Enjoy it. I'm glad you like it. I do enjoy the attempt that Al Ewing is doing to do something other than just, you know, a regular bad guys, a good guys beat up bad guys kind of comic. I like that he's trying something more literary, more artistic. Some of it worked for me. Some of it didn't. Art-wise,
I'm about in that range.
Art-wise, some people are saying in our Slack that the art was kind of a step down from previous issues. And I see where they're coming from. For instance, not only you, though. There was a couple others. I forget who else. Probably Matt as well. Part of it, I think, not all, but part of it is just that this issue takes place in the Marvel real world, which is still super fantastic, but it's not like the afterlife with the last two issues where the artist could just kind of run wild and do all sorts of crazy stuff. Because it was all, you know, of the mind, not really happening. So just being constrained a little bit by reality. But yeah, I think I see where you're coming from. There's no single page that makes me want to, you know, blow it up and put it on the wall here. Not that it was bad, but the previous couple issues had some real, real wow pages and not as much here. So to sum up, this issue is worth reading. Didn't give me a headache the way the last couple did. I appreciate Al Ewing trying to stretch his arms a little bit and do something cool. I'm glad Magneto is back. And to me, I'm going to give this a 7.5 out of 10.
Yeah, I'll go with 7. The whole event kind of, I don't know if it's an event, but, you know, this series of issues was kind of dull a little bit to me. But I don't know. It was all right. I don't regret reading it. It just wasn't, I don't think I'll ever think back on this. And it won't be like there was this cool way that he came back. And I think my biggest gripe about all of this is they're trying, like Al Ewing's really trying to add some depth and complexity to Eric's personality. And I'm not convinced anybody else is going to, you know, show him struggling with this, especially with like him leading the X-Men, right? The next writer is just going to present him however they want to present him. And yeah,
that is the problem with these long form multi-writer over the decades kind of universes, right? That you want to tell a story, and in a story, a character has an arc. He grows, and he changes, and he's different at the end. But Superman's always going to be Superman. Lex Luthor is going to be kind of a little bit good, kind of a little bit bad, but he's always going to come back to being Lex Luthor. And Magneto is always going to basically be Magneto. So it's hard to really make a change to a character that's going to stick. And this ends Al Ewing's time on the X-Books, at least for now. I've heard a rumor that in this new Ultimate Universe kind of thing that DC is starting, which they're going to call the DC Absolute, I think, what I hear is Al Ewing might be writing a Wonder Woman title over.
Interesting. Just
a rumor. Could be completely made up, but I'd certainly check that out.
Yeah. Yeah, I know Jim doesn't particularly like Ewing, but I actually found him to be pretty interesting and was more positive on most of his stuff on the X-Books than some of the other writers.
Yeah, I like Al Ewing's work. I think X-Men Red, and as that was, you know, kind of came out of the Sword book, I like that better than some other Al Ewing things I've read. In Magneto, in this Resurrection Magneto series, he kind of goes back into that super symbolic, metaphorical thing that he was doing in Immortal Hulk, and that made Jim kind of run away screaming. So I like Al Ewing with the themes and the symbolism in there, but kind of turned down in the background. I like that, you know, I want the subtext to be subtext, not shoved in my face. So we'll see what happens with Wonder Woman. And I'm sure Jim and Eric will be talking all about that on the DC podcast. So tune into that for more. And now we're going to talk about the last book in our little podcast today, which is Invincible Iron Man number 17, The Price of Knowledge, written by Jerry Duggan. Guest artist Patch Zercher. Creasley will be back in the next issue, according to solicits. Colors by Brian Valenza. Letters by Joe Caramagna. Now, the title page of the last issue, the All Splash page one, had a dedication to Walt Simonson and Sal Buscema. Title page of this issue has a note that reads, "With love and admiration to the work of David Michelinie, Barry Windsor Smith, and Bob Layton." The best guess on what specific idiom this comes from, what it's referring to, comes from the guy who edits my podcasts, a guy named James. I think you know him. James suggests that Iron Man number 232 from 1988 might be what they're kind of homaging here. That issue was written by Michelinie and Winsor Smith, penciled by Winsor Smith and inked by Layton. So there's that trio. That issue features an extended of the mind scene in which Tony confronts the demons of his past, which, as you'll see, makes it a pretty good candidate for what they're talking about. This issue, the one from 2024, is a book of two distinct halves. The first half is an extended of the mind scene in which Tony confronts the demons of his past. That sounds familiar. Second half is a fistfight between Tony and Fei Long, followed by a quick wrap up and a setup for next issue. By the way, no mention of Rhodey in this issue.
Yeah, I'm kind of like wondering what happened to him.
We didn't see Rhodey of the mind at all.
Yeah, we also saw, it was like Sandman or somebody in like a different prison recently, and I was like, isn't he supposed to be guarding Rhodey?
That continuity, exactly when each book takes place relative to each other, is a little bit sketchy. My guess as to what's going on with Rhodey is I think that we were supposed to see him again, but then when the whole end of the Fall of X kind of got pushed up in the schedule, I think the Rhodey story had to be kind of pushed aside for now. So we're going to get to him eventually. You can see in the solicits, there is a book coming up that, solicits change, but in a few months, there is going to be a Rhodey-centric issue. So, this issue. You'll remember that Tony was wearing his new Mark 72 Mysterium suit and piloting his even newer Mark 73 Sentinel Buster suit. He got knocked around a bit, and because, like a dummy, he took off his helmet, seems to have gotten a bit of a concussion. Because Tony spends about 9 pages here hallucinatingly seeing all his dead old friends, enemies, and family members. Not all that different from a Kieran Gillen issue a few years ago, the 2023 AXE:Avengers, which was a tie-in book to the Judgment Day event. In that issue, Tony wandered around inside the body of the Progenitor, hallucinating instead of here inside the twisted wreck of the Sentinel Buster and hallucinating. Not a huge fan of these psychological of-the-mind stories, but as these things go, this one's not too bad. But Tony sees his mom and his stepmom having tea, and then their faces turn into Iron Man faces. Okay, that's dreamlike enough. Tony sees his friend Wei, who I had mostly forgotten was the guy Fei Long killed off at the very start of this volume to kick off the whole storyline of why Iron Man, Tony Stark, wants to get Fei Long. So that was a nice reminder there just to kind of, hey, readers, don't forget this thing is still a thing. Tony sees a whole splash page full of costume characters who Deathly played a part in, Obadiah Stone, Justin Hammer, Crimson Cowl, etc. And then we get a couple pages of Tony confronted by a hallucination of Magneto. They go back and forth a bit on guilt and culpability and Tony being a weapons dealer, all that stuff, whether people can fundamentally change. And then the last person Tony hallucinates is, of course, his dad, Howard Stark. All the Marvel heroes have daddy issues. Every single one of them. In this section, Tony is drawn wearing his very first Mark I armor that he made while being held captive in a cave. Howard compliments Tony's engineering but says, hey, guys like us, we're both going to hell for stealing knowledge from the gods, the whole Prometheus thing. As hallucinatory dad is about to crack Tony's skull wide open, Tony wakes up. Here we are onto part two of the issue. Tony's now into the chest area of the Sentinel Buster, which is where Fei Long's armor, busted into him last issue. Fei Long is there and whacks Tony's still unprotected head from behind with what looks like a piece of rebar. Tony should be dead now, right? He doesn't have a healing factor, no superpowers. He's just your basic baseline human here. And a strong adult male just cracked him in the back of the skull with a metal bar on top of his concussion. He should be dead. I get it. It's a comic book. It's Iron Man. He's on the title page. He's going to be mostly fine. We get a fight of repulsor beams. Fei Long tries to use his gross green mouth energy blast power. Tony wins the fight and is about to murder Fei Long to death with a repulsor blast at point blank range. And Fei Long is kind of okay with this. He kind of wants to die. He knows things. Here's where he tells Tony something that we dedicated X-Book readers have known for a while now, but would be news to anyone just reading Iron Man. Fei Long tells us that Orcus, get this, has been secretly controlled by a cabal of its AI members, and the AIs are no longer hiding it. Fei Long can't control the Stark Sentinels. He couldn't tell them to power down if he wanted to. It's not Orcus versus mutants anymore. It's AIs against both mutants and humans. So now Tony knows as well. Wrap-up time. Tony and Emma have a psychic chat. They both already know the deal with the AIs independently. Tony still has a flock of Stark Sentinels ready to kill him. Is that the right collective noun, a flock of Stark Sentinels? I'll have to work on that. Quickly, because they're all going to be gone soon. They're in Australia. He needs help. And what help is Emma going to send? We know. We've already seen that call be made. And on the final page of the issue, that help shows up. It's the real Magneto who says, "Hello, Stark, your wife sent me." Which, okay, that's a cool ending. You know, that's a cool look to Magneto. He gets to deliver a cool guy line. And next issue, we should get to see Tony and Magneto team up and get rid of those remaining Stark Sentinels.
Yeah.
Which, of course, makes me wonder, how is that this fight going to compare with the one we just saw at the end of Resurrection of Magneto, where it took three super powerful characters, you know, working really hard to take down that one Stark Sentinel?
Yeah.
Did Magneto learn anything there? Does Jerry Duggan even know about that scene? We'll have to wait and see. So this issue, the art by Pat Zercher, I really liked. Different style than what we've been getting from Kreese Lee. Lee's pages look very slick, shiny, and high-tech. Zercher's look grittier, more twisted and angular, a lot more little short black lines for texture, and it really works with the grittier content of this issue. The whole of the mind thing, I don't think we learned anything about Tony Stark that we didn't know, we haven't seen a thousand times over. I did like that Duggan resist the cliche of giving us the, "Oh, you're a drunk Tony" thing. I'm glad to not see that. I've seen that too many times, so thank you for skipping us with that. It is good to see the Phalanx fight wrapped up, although Tony still doesn't own his company and the tech anymore, so he's still that kind of end of things to wrap up. And it's good that the AI conspiracy is now fully out in the open, which at least this event that's been kind of dragging, that is some progress there. Everybody knows, you know, Orcus was just really a front for these AIs to do their thing. Interesting that Phalanx gets captured but survives, which is pretty much unique for the major Orcus villains of the story, right? Dr. Stasis is dead. Dr. Devo is dead. Dr. Gregor is dead. Phalanx still alive. I wonder why they made that choice.
Maybe they're trying to develop a long-term Tony Stark villain.
I mean, it could be. This book is not technically part of the X-Office, although it ties in so closely. So maybe the X-editors are saying, yeah, kill off anybody you want to kill off. Maybe these editors here are not quite as bloodthirsty. So high-level art, okay story. Call that for me a 7 out of 10. Not great, not terrible. How about you, Ruben? Where are you at?
Yeah, again, I my heart just wasn't in it this week. It was okay, but it just didn't excite me. I was just kind of like, eh.
It was okay. That kind of week, yeah.
Yeah, so I don't know, maybe 6.8.
6.8, that's fine, yeah. All these books, none of the books this week were super exciting. The only really big, well, I mean, Magneto's back. He was reborn the previous issue of Resurrection, so maybe that was the news, but that wraps up. That's kind of big. Phalanx being captured, that's kind of big. But yeah, we're expecting bigger things to happen, and we're going to maybe get those next week, because next week should be more exciting. Only two books, but those books are Dead X-Men number 4, which is the final issue of that series about our, you know, kind of dumb team who was supposed to be the team after the gala, but, you know, got killed. And we have Fall of the House of X number 4, the penultimate issue of that series. So yeah, those could be bigger. I have hope that especially Dead X-Men number 4, I'm really curious how that wraps up. No suggested reading for me this week, but I do have some suggested viewing. I've gotten into anime pretty big the past few years, and I love the start of new anime season, and I love that it happens 4 times a year. We get like 60 new shows that come out every 4 months, and I love turning on a new number one episode and having no idea what it's going to be. They're usually not great, you know, but once in a while you get something terrific. The spring season is underway, and I suggest folks out there, you might want to check out a show called Sandland, which in the U.S. is on Hulu, so you don't even need to subscribe to any dedicated anime thing to check it out. Sandland is based on a short manga series by a guy named Akira Toriyama, who also did a little book called Dragon Ball. The first ep of Sandland was a ton of fun, very cool character designs from Toriyama as always, and hey, check it out. If you have Hulu anyway, turn it on, see what you think. I think it's a good time.
Interesting. Yeah, I might check that out, and especially with Toriyama's death recently.
That's, yeah, he recently passed away. This was, I think it's like a 2-volume story he put out. It was meant to be short. It has, I don't know what the ending is, but it has a beginning and an end, and just cool characters. They look really neat, worth looking. So that's
I'll give a more X-Men related rec. You should check out X-Men 97. Mm-hmm. The fifth-ish episode just came out and had lots of people crying.
Talk about that online. In fact, I used the Twitter hashtag X-Spoilers, and it's hard to find any talk about the actual comics these days because it's all full of people talking about the cartoon show. So, folks, get your own damn hashtag. Come on. What are you doing? Cluttering up my screen. And that's all we have to talk about today. You have some stuff to watch between now and then. And other than watching TV, Ruben, what else do you suggest our fine listeners might do for the next 7 days?
Yeah, read more X-Men comics.